Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Dhyan Arjuna. Arjuna took sannyas in 1980 and is an expert on the prophecies of Nostradamus and author of 59 books. His bestseller Nostradamus and the Millennium sold over 700,000 copies. Arjuna is a sought-after guest for radio and TV talk shows. I'm so happy to have Arjuna on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Arjuna, welcome to the show. How are you?
So glad to do this.
Great. So, to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
I came across Osho after about 4 years before I came across him. I was a young opera singer, but with a very promising career. I was a protege of William Chapman of the New York City Opera, and I was being groomed to go into the German opera houses pretty soon. But I realized that I couldn't handle the politics. I loved singing opera, but I couldn't handle the politics, and I couldn't handle all the neediness of everybody, all the performers wanting, feeling good unless they didn't feel good unless they were being applauded. So I went back to my first passion, which was to become a writer and create my own works. So in the process of that developing, I also started to ask what it's all about. And it was at first a very intellectual pursuit. And when I exhausted the intellectual pursuit of it, pretty much had a nervous breakthrough to see how I realized that that's the best I could do. I needed help. My being started calling out for help. So one day I was going into a bookstore, a very big one, no longer exists in L.A., Los Angeles, that's where I was growing up, in Southern California. I went into the New Age section, and I saw the picture of a man in a turban, and I was immediately attracted to this person. At first I thought he was some Persian or something mystic, and it was Osho. And but the book that I bought, the first book, really I gravitated to was For Madmen Only. And it was one of the Darshan Diaries. And I don't recall who wrote it, but I opened the book and I loved the way it began. It's sort of this participatory way that I also write in my articles and books, where I talk one-on-one with the reader in a conversational format. And this guy saying, look, if you're reading this, you're in great danger. You're in great danger. So this is a dangerous guy that you're looking at. So look to your left, look to your right, very carefully put the book back into the bookshelf and quietly walk away. And then there's this pause between, so I kept reading, and he says, are you still reading? Oh, I used to be like you. And then he goes on in this whole thing about celebrating, you know, divine madness. And I just really appealed to me. So I read that book. And the next step was when I was listening to the Dhammapada series, and Osho was talking about how people have their own understanding of things. He was funny. He was ordinary. He had this incredible presence, but he was ordinary. And he told great toilet jokes, which none of the other people I was reading, Krishnamurti and other people, had. So that was a big moment. Then the third moment was when I was doing meditations, and suddenly I was in this strange experience of having a kind of a manic depressant moment where I was high, low, literally like this, up, down, up, down, up, down. And finally I went to bed fitfully trying to sleep. And then I felt this presence fill my bedroom. And I sat up and I said, And I sat, as I sat up, I heard his voice in the center of my head, as clear as I hear my own voice speaking now, say, "Be aware." And then I kind of said out loud, "Did that really happen?" And then I was just like the first time just watching my mind trying to negate what did happen. And in that one instant, I knew that as long as I lived, Osho was my master. And it was odd because I didn't even know there were other people. I realized that moment that I was going to India. So the next morning, I come in and see my mother, who later became a sannyasin too, and I told her, I said, I have to go seek this man. I think he's the man that can help me. I've gone as far as I can go on my own. And she quietly cried and sat and laid there saying, "You know, in a funny way, it's right. It's right that you're going. I'll help you with some money." What then comes now is my initiation into sannyas, which happened at 7:20 p.m. on the 15th of October, 1980. I was the second one in line. Osho used to line up everybody to the side, and there was Shiva, the guard, to kind of always tuck people. Everybody always went too close to Osho. This was the time when you couldn't touch his feet. But he was sitting in his beautiful Egyptian cotton robe without a hat in those days. And he's looking at each of us so lovingly, and there's such luminosity in his eyes. He's looking at each person, and he's waving his hand very lovingly saying, "Close your eyes." It was the first hardest thing to do. He was so radiant. I closed my eyes. I was squeezing them. And the first person, he gave him sannyas. So I'm listening. I'm listening to his voice, and my eyes are squeezed close. And I really want to look at him. I want to drink him up with my eyes. And then there was this laughter. I could feel a feeling of wanting to laugh too. And I just opened my eyes, and he was looking at me, smiling and nodding. And it was almost like, isn't this moment everything? You know, it had that quality of, he was just a guy, but a luminous person smiling and nodding at me. And I smiled at him and nodded back and closed my eyes again. So then, as I'm sitting there, I feel this presence of almost like invisible fingers touching my face, like, "You open your eyes." And I very, very carefully opened my eyes. And there he was with his eyes big and wide and bright, pointing at me to come, going, like that. And then I went, "Oh," like that, and got up. Everybody's laughing. I got up, I sat next to him. Shiva pulls me back, too close. And then Osho leans in, and it's, you know, like nose to nose almost, and he touches me with his finger. I feel a slight electric shock. And unlike what everybody in the line for Darshan and the days before were saying, they were all talking about, "Oh man, when this happens, you know, some amazing stuff's going to happen. You know, all this orgasmic, whatever, this and that." So everybody's telling me all, building up all this anticipation. But when he touched me, and I couldn't give words to it then, but I can now, what he gave me was absolutely nothing. And it soaked from my eye, my third eye, down through my toes. He did something right there, which gave me an experience of no pointness, no goal, nothingness. And it has changed everything in the subtlest way, because nothing happened. So anyway, I get ready for him to speak. And he says, the first thing he says is, "Make only one ambition in your life, to begin meditation." And I smiled a little because, you know, he seemed to understand I was very subtly ambitious. And he said, what I heard him say was, meditation has two parts. In the first part, you're needed. So you're needed to prepare the body-mind vehicle. You're needed each moment, this moment, to be here, always in the beginning of watching. And he said, "There." And if you go totally into this, there'll come a point where, and you have not earned it. He really was stressing that. You have not earned it. It comes on its own accord, is the second part of meditation, where you disappear and it remains. He went on talking about many things, but as I looked at him, I saw things that were impossible to see. I saw him not being there at all. He was not there. And he was like a sky that decided to give a message of what it's like to be an endless sky. You see it, but you cannot really say it's there. The context of its there-ness are things that are transitory, like windows you look out of or horizons you walk towards. But it's not there. But it's full of its not there-ness. And he was also, my impression of him was that he was deader than a corpse. He really has died. The separate man, Rajneesh Chandra Mohan, died at 21 years old. And yet, he's speaking to me. He's on many levels reaching invisibly into me and planting seeds like I'm a field for a harvest. And I felt it happening as if the talking was just to keep my attention upon his eyes, as all these other things were coming in and seeding themselves with a garden of not thereing. And so I'm listening to him, and at one point he says, he gets personal with it about dropping the mind. He looks at me and says, "And you must drop the mind because your mind is so full of junk." And I cracked up because it was true.
So, well, thank you so much for this beautiful description of how you came across Osho. As you mentioned, you abandoned a very promising career as a singer. I can hear your voice. You have a very rich and deep voice. So I'm sure you would have been a wonderful singer. But you decided to pursue your interest in mysticism, meditation, and prophecy. So you are an expert on prophecy, especially on Nostradamus. I'm wondering if you have ever spoken to Osho about these topics, or if Osho did ever speak about that?
Well, he did. When my first book, Nostradamus and the Millennium, was published in 1987, I got a call from Manisha that Osho wanted me to come and be present for the Golden Future Discourse that was going to happen in May of 1987. This would be the first time since the ranch ended that I would actually go back to India. And basically he wanted to be there, me to be there, because he wanted to comment on my book. And so I said, "Well, Manisha, tell him, I don't know how I'll get there, but I'll be there." So I managed 2 weeks later, the end of April, to arrive. And so I was there. And it ended up being a process. He did comment on my book. He called it one of the most significant books of the 20th century. However, I think more in what it was trying to accomplish by helping getting him out into the world than merely about Nostradamus, because, of course, in Osho's ability to contain all contradictions, he had said, in fact, I'd read it after finishing the book, that Nostradamus was insane, and I use all kinds of silliness and foolishness to awaken the world. So I take that to mean as a device, and that issue came up later when I felt that with Osho there are more layers. It wasn't just to be there present when this happened. I started going through a process with him that is actually what gave birth to what I've been doing, why I'm talking all over the world since 1987, May. I asked him a letter, a private letter, where I said I have, and I gave it to Anando, Ma Anando, at the gate at his house, Lao Tzu, at where I said, I have a strong premonition that I'm going to be speaking to millions of people in the future, that this book is going to be a major success. It had just come out, so we didn't know. And how should I present myself? She brought it in to Osho and then came out later and said, you know, and if it had been just some vainglorious ego trip, I think he would have just said, just be ordinary and everything's fine. But he actually gave her notes and gave basically me the instructions of how to do what I do, how to prepare myself and be out of the way and feel him, feel his isness. And he said, from there, whatever happens, is whatever you say or do is perfectly right. And so it was almost like the way Osho says things by not saying anything about it in between the lines. Clearly he was, and it was kind of wonderful and scary at the same time, he's saying basically without saying it, yes, you will be speaking to millions of people. But he also said something that really pushed my buttons. He said, I want you to be John Hogue, not Arjuna, when you're doing this. And I kind of was like, wow. I was thinking of all the other authors that I knew who Osho had said, use your sannyas name, who all ended up using their legal names. And I heard the tale about how a lot of them were like, Osho said, I told you to use your sannyas name. So with that gossip in the back of my head, I said, but tell Osho, I said to Ananda, I'm happy to be Arjuna. I'm happy to be on the rooftops calling that I am Arjuna. And she said, yes, but Osho said that you'll reach many more people as John Hogue. So I find it kind of funny when I get accosted by sannyasins who obviously haven't read any of my books and don't understand how I insert a lot of Osho and the fact that now I talk about it. That's the other thing. It was like, you know, be John Hogue, but as a generation passed, that's 21 years actually passed since that time in 87. I started to, in those spaces, as he trained me how to do it, I started to feel that in this beautiful presence, I could adapt things. It just happened spontaneously. It just happened. And so I realized later that it was because a whole generation of people who hated him, who were in power and stuff, that generation had passed on or moved on. There was a new generation that didn't have any of that charge. And so I began to talk about how I was John Hogue, the famous Nostradamus author, who also was directly involved in trying to be a part of the process of creating a new humanity, which its primary prophet was Osho. And so I began inserting cautiously, carefully, more and more stories and seeing that the feedback was very welcoming. So now for years, my relationship as being a sannyasin and John Hogue, or what also happened was that I wrote a letter and passed it to Anando in this process of getting advice. She was the go-between. I didn't meet Osho in person with this, but definitely things were happening. Kind of like the way I was touched on the forehead before. Nothing was really happening, but things were happening on their own, and there was an availability. So I wrote this letter. I said, you know, I wrote this book. I did not ask you for permission to do it. I could not help but write this. This book was like breathing. It was like my heartbeat. I could not help myself but do it. And if it was wrong, I would face the music, as we say, with you about it. And when you say that Nostradamus was insane, and I can't argue for or against that. He's certainly mad and mad prophet, but he did see you. I stand on that. He did see you coming. But then I wrote something that came from a deeper space that I was taken, and it's suddenly I wrote, but I don't care if he sees him. I see you. And now it is like, you said You said you use all kinds of foolishness to awaken the world. So I'm hoping that your foolish Arjuna in this foolish book is part of that. Anando read him the letter. And Anando was really great at acting out how Osho responded to things. That was really wonderful. And so she said, and he did something he rarely does when I'm doing this. He put his hands high over his head and had such a beautiful, radiant smile. He went, good. He was very happy, she said. So all through the time, whenever letters were passed, up until the time he left his body, he was very encouraging of what I'm doing. And I keep doing it until my last breath, or till the moment it stops. That's all fine for me.
Arjuna, do you feel that new generations and young people nowadays, they receive Osho in a different way? Or do you see any difference in the way people receive Osho today compared to, you know, 10, 20 years before?
Well, it always will change. Because in my work in judicial predictive astrology, which is a lot of the basis of how I predict world events and political campaigns thing, and just the whole nature of the collective unconscious of people, that this is the pool where sometimes there comes periods, like a generational period of an opening, where the collective is still sleeping, but it's more open to things of the spirit and taking jumps. And certainly the 60s, especially into the 70s and up to 1985, there's a certain window that happened in the cycles of, it's what's called the fourth turning, actually, a theory of an 80-year cycles that history seems to go through. It's really quite like clockwork. It was a time when it was okay, even in the mainstream, for a whole lot of people to check things out, like somebody like Osho. And it's why there were probably 500,000 sannyasins and another 3 million people, or what Osho would call shravakas, listeners, that flocked to him from all over the world. And that is gone now, because we're in a different time now. Now it's more like the way it was for mysticism in the late 30s into the 40s. We're in the crisis point of every 80 years, there's a major crisis point. And last one was the Great Depression and World War II. Now we're entering the roaring 2020s, I call it, because it's roaring with all kinds of intensity. And it's literally the, when Osho used to talk about, I'll put my prophecy hat on, when Osho used to talk about the year 2000 as the time when the old humanity would start its auto-suicidal tendencies, I sometimes wonder if he gave the world grace, a grace of 20 years, because a lot of the things he said was going to happen in 2000 are definitely beginning now. So we're in a crisis period. The people are coming, the people that I deal with, now I certainly can't speak for all the people out there like Sarita and others who are working with people and groups and things like that, and meditation therapy and all that. But in the way that I deal with the public, and the way I also always offer to give people Osho meditations, and there it's in my articles and books, and I've given that to thousands of people in the last decades. It's now a little hard. It doesn't have the ease of kind of going off on a bus across Afghanistan from Europe to kind of do the hippie thing and go there and then suddenly find yourself a sannyasin. And that era is gone. So it's new. And in the newness, sometimes when I'm dealing with people who come to me and say, "Bah, but you walked with Osho. You were there. You were a guard in Lao Tzu." Well, I used to feel very sad that I thought, man, these people don't have the support systems. I mean, I'd like to see, and I'm wanting to do more and more where people can do online meditation so that people can have the experience beyond just looking on YouTube and reading the books. But just really, in the time when I was becoming a sannyasin, it was the books immediately led you to find a place where you could do dynamic, or you got the tapes and you did dynamic. And so, you know, that more important kinesthetic action, you know, to, as Osho used to say, start with the body, because the body is the beginning. It stores everything and triggers everything. And I'm working towards more of that happening in any way I can, to get people less intellectually interested in Osho and more whole being interested.
You are a professional prophecy predictor. So what about Osho's work? Do you think that his vision and meditation will grow? You know, more and more people will embrace Osho's vision, or perhaps Osho will just become a name and historical figure?
Yes, well, the answer is yes and yes. There will be people who will exactly turn Osho into another person like Buddha. In fact, he's embraced now by India, by the mainstream in India, in ways that they never would have dared do when he was alive. And that's natural. But there's a different, on the other level, the other yes is that what he predicted, the critical confrontation of auto-suicidal humanity, is coming in the next 20 years. And so the potential there is for people who have been with him as well as people who have yet to be with him. And I can see it in my online readings. I do a lot of, I had a hiatus of 26 years where I had to kind of, in 1992, when I had this wide open empathic experience but I was attached to the pain and expectations of people that I was suddenly tuned into. It was like being burned by the sun, and I had to stop doing private readings until I could get used to find a way to be in that but not have the threat of identity, because it's identity that really makes me suffer. Not truth never made me suffer. Illusions make me suffer. Expectations, the most noble expectations, that thing people should wake up and be loving and all that, those are expectations. I had to start really grokking or understanding the statement that Osho shared with us in the Bodhidharma series, when Bodhidharma said, "My teaching is simply this, do not hold on to any appearances." And then Osho went on to say, you know, the world is an appearance, your body is an appearance, your mind is an appearance, your expectations. That I had to deal with, and it took me 26 years before I came back, just a year ago, September, to private readings again. And in a way, you can see a renaissance with a lot of older sannyasins as well as newer that's happening with Facebook and social media. That it's given Osho, along with Wild Wild Country, the six-part series at Netflix, it had a great impact. I mean, I used to work in the press corps in Pune, and Osho loved bad press. I'm glad to hear, I think, that there's no more lawsuits, because actually, and they're doing another one, I'm going to try to be on it. It turned an entire generation across America interested in Osho. Now, when I talk about Osho, thanks to Wild Wild Country, they're very interested. They keep telling me, people even in my little village here in Langley, Washington, they say, they all know I'm a sannyasin. They say, wow, I wish this show had shown Osho more. And explained why all you fascinating people, high life people, were there, and this beautiful place you built, and rather than put you all in the background. I said, well, you know, they went for the thing they knew, so they went for the sordid politics tale, you know, and they missed what. And hopefully now that they're going to try it again, they won't miss, because they promised us that they would do a lot of the day-to-day life of people on the ranch. And you know, the miracle of simply living there, just doing what we did, being who we were. And so what's happened in my readings now that I've come back is I seem to be attracting a certain people from all over the world who are those people I was talking about earlier, who have reached a point at very similar to the way I reached and others did in the 70s and early 80s, where they're seeking truth. They're seeking something bigger than anything that's out there. And they come and I do readings with them, and almost every one of them I'm giving them meditations. I'm talking about Osho and things like that.
That's reassuring, and hopefully you will make a big impact in transmitting Osho to the people who are ready for it. So for people who don't know much about prophecy, is prophecy more of a science or an art? The reality is that these type of things like prophecy or astrology are normally in the hands of charlatans, and they just exploit people's desire to know about the future. So what is the best approach to prophecy, for example, a healthy and realistic approach? How to take it?
Get out of your own way. That's simply it. And you can apply it to everything that you do or don't do. Get out of your own way. Walk without feet. Fly without wings. Think without mind. It has to be rooted in meditation. It has to be rooted in the premise. Because I'm speaking for myself. I can't speak for others. I can certainly talk about all the charlatans that are out there who have not done the work, have not done the necessary balance of knowing things, but then let going things. Knowing and let going has to meet in some mysterious way, so that in this empty space of innocence, and I emphasize the innocence, existence speaks, and you're the mailman, and you're just helping people, and you're not in control of anything you're saying, except that you're coming from a space of love and silence. And it is the same that I apply in my writing when I'm writing to the world, because a strange position I'm in is if there's a conflict in the world, I know for a fact that the CIA on one side is reading me and Al-Qaeda is reading me and everybody in between. And so there's an interesting responsibility one must have in the moment-to-moment of creating stuff, where you have to be empathic to the entire audience. And so the problem with most people in prophecy, and it's something in the early days I encountered is, before I started looking for Osho, was that people make the mistake of making their psychic part of themselves their center, that's who they are. And if you do that, either in big or subtle ways, you end up having a psychic meltdown, a fall of the magician, the fall of psychic pride, if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, if you're not total, even in that, then you may spend your entire life weaving bullshit and giving it a psychic milieu and waste your life and waste other people's lifetime, but they're also attracted. I mean, I have learned that people who are looking for lies find psychic people who give them lies. And from my own experience, people who are ready to look at, I just don't want the bullshit now, I want to know what this is, they're attracted to me. And the other thing too about divination is that I learned from studying Nostradamus, who, by the way, was a very sloppy astrologer. Of course, he didn't have the computers we had, but he was sloppy enough that there are a handful of astrologers that we don't even know their names, but they're in the footnotes of Nostradamus's life story because they complained in pamphlets about his bad astrology work. The problem was that Nostradamus was severely dyslexic. He used it to his advantage. I'm also dyslexic, so I understand. I can see it in his writing. What I came to understand is that he used whatever tool he needed to use to get into the zone of giving prophecy, or of the zone that a healer is in when they give healing, or the zone of a therapist gives when they give therapy. It's similar. When he did that, he didn't give a damn whether his astrology worked or not, because what is true is that in his mistaken astrology, what he interpreted, what he predicted, often was true. It happened. Now, he was also somebody who said he's also the man that proved and documented that history is not written in stone. And all the dogmas of all the religions that have been saying it is are wrong. And he proved it. And so he used to often talk about, it's kind of like he was trying to scare people straight in his 16th century modus operandi. And so I apply in my own work a lot of what I learned for 40 years studying the 16th century French, studying Nostradamus's life intimately, so that I could understand how he does what everybody else does with the future, filter it through an ego persona mask that his society gave him, with all its hopes and fears, its phobias, and all of that. And so it's very important to understand that about oneself, and then apply that understanding to Nostradamus. And the vast majority of the people have not done any study to catch themselves in the act of projecting the whole thing from their mind on Nostradamus and saying it, Nostradamus said that. So the deeper layer of problems with charlatanism in this field is that ultimately you become a charlatan unto your own reality. But I came to understand that I was the one projecting on the cloud, so I needed to allow the cloud just to be the cloud. And then, of course, when I was with Osho and became a meditator, that brought to a whole deeper level. So I am probably in the whole 460 years or so of Nostradamian history. Probably, I'm thinking about this right now. I never thought about it before. I'm probably the first one of all the interpreters who actually meditates.
So Arjuna, you are clearly a very prolific author. You wrote nearly 50 books, and you are a regular guest at many shows, radio shows, talk shows, TV shows, etc. So what are your latest projects? What are you up to now? What are you working at the moment?
Well, they kind of drop in suddenly. I usually talk to about 20 million Americans about five times a year on Coast to Coast AM. It actually covers all of North America. I just taped a show there's a show for History Channel. I do a lot of History Channel, and that should be coming out soon. I did one on the last Pope in 2018. And in early 2018, I ended up doing three national broadcast shows on the future, really beautifully made, high quality, and I wasn't censored. And it was in Russia. The crew came here to my island and they filmed me, and I ended up speaking to 100 million Russians from New Year's Eve, during the president's announcement at New Year's Eve, the biggest holiday in Russia. My show came right after that across 16 time zones. And long story short, the most important message, given the dire times that we're in, was here's this American who's actually talking about Edgar Cayce's very famous prophecy, which, by the way, Osho commented on in The Golden Future, about Russia being the hope of the world. It's a real prophecy, and it was documented and dated. The last time he uttered it, Cayce, was in 1944, where I presented to the Russians the prophecy and made the point that the new Russia that he's talking about, because Cayce said it wouldn't be Bolshevism, it would come after Bolshevism, that Russia would be new and renewed. And that America was, destiny was to help Russia, but it would not be helping Russia if it talked freedom and didn't practice it. I mean, I'm distilling the message down to its essential bits. And unfortunately, that's where America is with Russia today, is that we're setting ourselves up accidentally on purpose to fight Russia. Whenever there are crises in the world, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, if it comes back, it's something, the karmic echo effect, I call it. I've seen it a lot in prophecy, where a lesson or a test comes back by happenstance, mostly by people not learning. I mean, if people stop building nuclear weapons, and now that's starting to increase again, and just we're living peacefully, then of course this karmic echo would never utter itself and bounce off of their identification issues again in a future time. So the thing is, I was speaking to the Russians again this year, and it felt really, when you asked me what I'm trying to do to help things and make the history incline a different direction, as Nostradamus would say, I shared these beautiful prophecies of that Russia can, straddling the world, be a hope of the world. And if there's another Cuban Missile Crisis event over Syria and Iran, which is highly likely, there's no time in this interview to go into detail about the prophecies that set this up. But the thing that is really could happen is that if there's another thing as serious as the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost started World War III, now the karmic echo has reversed. Now the President Kennedy, who is a visionary, centered, mindful of the consequences, and is not the U.S. President, he's actually Khrushchev this time. beating a shoe on the table. Most likely will be President Trump, who's probably going to be a two-term president. The only person who really has a chance of beating him is Bloomberg. We'll see if that happens. But the person that could defuse the situation in 62 is Kennedy, the person who has the maturity. And I might add, President Putin, though he's an Orthodox Russian worshiper, I know from my contacts inside of Russia that his spiritual path is very meditative. He is several degree black belt in judo. He has a statue of the founder of judo in his house. I always had this feeling that there was a quality of centering and meditation about the ways he does things. And he is actually, through the martial arts, quite a meditator. And I would say that's probably why we're all still breathing. And it may very well be why we're still breathing between now and 2024.
Well, that's quite something. Let's see what will happen and hope for the best. So we are heading towards the end of the interview, and I've got three final questions for you. The first question is, what's your morning routine? What do you do normally in the first couple of hours of your day when you wake up?
Well, I'm usually watching my dreams until the dream changes and I wake up. And then the first major thing I do is do what I call a Vipassana walk. And I go through the fields and forests and do this walk that I read in one of Osho's books about, where you feel your feet pushing and pressing into the earth to feel the earth. You feel your senses. You watch your breath, breathing in and out. Your moves become very graceful as you get more in into the atomically small but endlessly vast moment where eternity exists. With no mind or no time, no goals, no things, you're just walking. And then there are moments where everything is connected. I finish that walk and then I come back to write. And it can be different in different times, but I write every day. And I write 7 days a week, and I often write about an average of 2,500 to 3,000 words a day, but sometimes 5,000 to 7,000 words. But what happened for me is, and it keeps getting bigger, as I go deeper into meditation and get more ripened like wine, the creativity has exponentially grown. The more effortless it becomes, the more is coming out of me.
So the second question is, what's your favorite meditation?
Being here now. Whether I'm sitting, which I often do, where I'll write for 2 hours, and then I'll get up, move around, and then I will sit for 20 or 40 minutes, and then write for 2 hours. It's the meditation of living, meditation of eating, the meditation. Meditation is 24/7. It's the meditation of inviting the Buddha to come along with me until I become his shadow. If it's actually a practice of a certain discipline of meditation, right now it's my Zen walks. But at any moment it could change, be something else. When I was starting off in all the major meditations, Dynamic Kundalini, Gaur Shankar, all of those, for some reason I would do them every night for 6 months, or every day for 6 months. Then it just stopped. So I mean, everybody has their way and uniqueness to it. So the techniques are not the meditation. So my favorite meditation is here now, but the techniques help.
The last question is, you lead the Osho experiment. You were one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2020?
Well, on many levels, it means so many things. I mean, to myself, to my own remembrance of the new man. And the other thing, too, is that in the outer work that I'm doing, is that this is exactly what we're trying in 87 to smuggle through writing books about Nostradamus. That's just the starting of the conversation. I'm a smuggler of the new man. That has always been and always will be what I am, no matter what I and how I do it. And given the popularity or the celebrity meditation that I have to deal with, there is also a gift to it, is to I have access to lots of people. Whether Whether they are taking it in or not is really none of my business. It is their freedom even to destroy the world. That was the hardest expectation I had, is that to understand that people are absolutely free to make the world a paradise or destroy it, and that cannot be trespassed upon. However, I'm writing two books this year. They'll be out this year. One called The Roaring 2020s, Decade of Death and Transformation, and also a book that's going to be about the prophecies of climate change, climate catastrophe. And it will really look at the whole issue of this being the first extinction, not the sixth extinction, the first extinction, that some animals on this planet, what Suleiman Deda used to call talking animals, have the potential to actually be aware that they're facing an extinction. A bark beetle isn't aware of it. A dinosaur isn't aware of it. We're aware of it. So this is the first extinction. And there's a very interesting commonality in prophecies all around the world, ancient and modern, which all indicate that the vast majority of the people are going to drop dead from not being able, not wanting to adapt to the unknown. They want to project and go on projecting onto that unknown, the past, and that will be their auto-suicide. There's different ways, like the Hopis call about drop dead from their own fear of change. But this is the core issue, and most of the human race is not going to make it. However, those who bring more consciousness into their lives, those who become more a Noah's Ark of consciousness, an inner eye in the center of these stormy times we're about to come into, this unraveling, from that small group around the world, I can say it, but not with tension, but with more totality, how important it is for everyone who has been with someone like Osho to allow their meditation to deepen and live by example your unique way, and not be caught up in who did what on the ranch and stuff like that, but just drop all that crap and just be here now. And feel the presence of Osho. And it's this kind of thing that I heard him say is what's needed, that to spread the message of the new man is to live like the new man. And then you will be like candles lighting other candles. And it's possible that this could very well be what preserves enough of the human race when the population of humanity crashes in the 2030s that can rebuild the world in the next 1,000 years of recovery and create a new humanity as a visitor in this world of time and mind. That at least is my hypothesis. Not to be believed, just me saying this. If you resonate with it, great. If you don't resonate with it, great.
Okay, well, that's very beautiful. Well, thank you, Arjuna. On these notes, we can end this beautiful interview. Thank you so much for sharing so abundantly everything you have inside, all your experience of many years with Osho. Thank you so much for being part of the Love Osho podcast, and lots of love.
Lots of love to you again and everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Love Osho podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit loveosho.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.